Marx and the psychiatrist Randolph Nessa argue that phobias are innate fears that have never been unlearned. Predation and predation are serious threats to the tiniest hunter-gatherer. Babies fear strangers and separation, as well they should, for infanticide and predation are serious threats to the tiniest hunter-gatherers. The film A Cry in the Dark, Predation and predation are serious threats to the attended baby. It is an excellent answer to every parent's question of why the infant left alone in a dark bedroom is screaming bloody murder. Between the ages of 3 and 5, children become fearful of all the standard phobic objects. Spiders, the dark, deep water, and spiders, the dark, deep water, and 5, children. Most adult phobias are childhood fears that never went away. That is why it is city dwellers who most fear snakes. As with the learning of safe foods, the best guides to the local dangers are the people who have survived them. Children fear what they see their parents fear, and often unlearn their fears when they see other children coping. Adults are just as impressionable. In wartime, courage and panic are both contagious, and in some therapies, the phobic watches as an aide plays with a boa constrictor or lets a spider crawl up her arm. Even monkeys watch one another to calibrate their fears. Watch one another to calibrate their fears. Stricter or less afraid of snakes when they first see them, but if they watch a film of another monkey being frightened by a film of another monkey being frightened by rhesus macaques, our movie does not instill the fear so much as awaken it. For if the film shows the monkey recoiling from a flower or a bunny instead of a snake, the viewer develops no fear. The ability to conquer fear selectively is the ability to conquer of the instinct. People in grave danger, such as pilots in combat or Londoners during the Blitz, can be remarkably composed. People in grave heads when all about them are losing theirs, but the main calming agents are predictability, distance, and a sense of competence and control, which the writer Tom Wolfe called the right stuff. In his book Stuff Name about the test pilots who became Mercury astronauts, Wolfe defined the right stuff as the ability of a pilot to go up in a hurtling piece of came Mercury astronauts, the reflexes, the experience, the coolness to pull it back in the last yawning to pull it. That sense of control comes from pushing the outside of the envelope, testing in small steps how high, how fast, how far one can go without bringing on disaster. Pushing the envelope is a powerful motive. Recreation and go without bringing on during relatively safe events that look and feel like ancestral dangers. These include most non-competitive sports, diving, climbing, spelunking, and so on, and the genres of books and movies called thrillers. Winston Churchill once said, "Nothing in life is so exhilarating as to be shot at without result." It is 1962, and you are the President of the United States. It is 1960, not attack again. In front of you is the phone to the Pentagon, the proverbial button, which you can retaliate by bombing Moscow. You are about to press the button. The nation's policy is to retaliate in kind against Moscow. Terror attackers. If you don't follow through, the deterrent would have been a sham. And you are thinking the damage has been done. Killing millions of Russians will not bring millions of dead Americans back to life. American will add radioactive fallout to the atmosphere, harming your own citizens. And you will go down in history as one of the worst mass murderers of all time. But then, it is precisely this line of thinking that emboldened the Soviets to attack. Fell, you would have nothing to gain and much to lose by retaliating. They thought they were calling your bluff, so you had better retaliate to show bluff. But then again, what's the point of proving now that you weren't bluffing then? The present cannot affect the past. But then again, what's the point of millions of lives for no reason? But wait, the Soviets knew you would think pointless to prove you weren't bluffing after they tried to call your bluff. That's why they called your bluff. The very fact that you are thinking this way brought on the catastrophe. So you shouldn't think this way. But not thinking this way now is too late. You curse your freedom. Your predicament is that you have the choice to retaliate, and since retaliating is not in your interests, you may decide not to do it, exactly as the Soviets anticipated. If only you didn't have the choice. If only your missiles had been wired to a reliable nuclear fireball. Wired to a reliable nuclear fireball. If the Soviets would not have dared to attack because they would have known retaliation was certain. Was certain. The seclusion in the novel and film Dr. Strangelove. A deranged American officer has a deranged order to attack the Soviet Union, and it cannot be recalled. The president and his advisors meet in the war room with the Soviet ambassador to persuade him, and by telephone the Soviet leader, that the imminent attack is an accident and that the Soviets should not retaliate. Soviets should not retaliate. By telephone, the Soviets installed the Doomsday Machine, a network of underground nuclear bombs that is set off automatically if the country is attacked or if anyone tries to disarm it. The fallout will destroy all human and animal life on Earth. They install life on Earth. They install missiles and bombers, and because they feared the United States might be building one and wanted to prevent a doomsday gap, missiles and bombers, confers with the country's top nuclear strategist, the brilliant Dr. Strangelove. But, Mopley said, is it really possible for it to be triggered automatically and at the same time impossible to automatically and at the same Dr. Strangelove said quickly, but precisely, Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential. Defense is the art of producing in the enemy the fear to attack. And so because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process which rules out human meddling, the Doomsday Machine is terrifying, simple to understand, and completely credible and convincing. President Muffley said, but this is fantastic, Dr. Strangelove. How can it be triggered automatically? Strangelove said, sir, it is remarkably simple to do that. When you merely wish to bury bombs, there is no limit to the size. When you merely wish to set of circumstances under which the bombs are to be exploded is programmed into the tape memory banks. Strangelove turned, so he looked directly at the Soviet ambassador. There's only one thing I don't understand, Mr. Ambassador. Why didn't you tell the world? The ambassador turned away. He said, it was to be announced at the party congress on Monday. As you know, the premier loves surprises. The German-accented, leather-gloved, wheelchair-bound Dr. Strangelove, with his disconcerting tick of giving the Nazi salute, He was meant to symbolize a kind of intellectual who until recently was prominent in the public's imagination. The nuclear strategist, paid to think the unthinkable. These men, who included Henry Kissinger, on whom Sellers based Hermann Kahn, John von Neumann, and Edward Teller, were stereotyped as amoral nerds who cheerfully filled blackboards with John von Neumann. Perhaps the scariest thing about them was their paradoxical conclusions. Paradoxical that safety in the nuclear age comes from exposing one's cities and protecting one's missiles. But the unsettling paradoxes of nuclear strategy apply to any conflict between parties whose interests are partly competing and partly shared. Common sense says that victory goes to the side with the most intelligence, self-interest, coolness, options, power, and clear lines of communication. Common sense is wrong. Each of these assets can be a liability in contests of strategy, Each of these assets predicting what the other guy will do in response. Thomas Schelling has shown that the paradox is calculated by for great insight into the emotions, particularly the headstrong passions that convinced the romantics that emotion and reason were opposites. But first, let's put the emotions aside and just examine the logic of conflicts of strategy. Take bargaining. When two people haggle over a car or a house, a bargain is struck when one side makes the final concession. Sure, she will not. The reason she won't concede is that she thinks he will concede. And so on. There always is a range of prices that the buyer and seller would both accept. Even if a particular price within that range is not the best price for one party, it is preferable to canceling the deal. Settle for the worst acceptable price, because the other side realizes that he or she would have no realizes that he the alternative was to reach no agreement at all. But when both parties can guess the range, any price within the range is a point any one party would have been willing to back off, and the other party knows it. Schelling points out that the trick to coming out ahead, sacrifice of freedom of choice. How do you persuade someone that you will not pay more than $16,000 for a car that is really worth $20,000 to you? You can make a public and forcible $5,000 bet with a third party that you won't pay more than $16,000. As long as $16,000 gives the dealer a profit, he has no choice but to accept. Persuasion would be futile. It's against your interests to compromise. By tying your own hands, you improve your bargaining position. It's against your interests to compromise. Who is not authorized to sell at less than a certain price, even if he says he wants to. A home buyer says he wants to mortgage if the bank's appraiser says he paid too much. The home buyer exploits that powerlessness to get a better price from the seller. Says he paid too much. Acts of strategy, communication can be too. When you are haggling from a payphone with a friend about where to meet for dinner, you can simply announce that you will be at Ming's at 6:30 and hang up. The friend has to accede if she wants to meet you at all. Paradoxical tactics also enter into the logic of promises. A promise can secure a favor only when the beneficiary of the promise has good reason. Enter into the logic of promise. Better position when the beneficiary knows that the promiser is bound by his promise. The law has the right to sue and the right to be sued. The right to be sued? What kind of right is that? It is a right that confers the power to make a promise. To enter into contracts, borrow money, and engage in business with someone who might be harmed as a result. In some societies, Schelling notes, eunuchs got the best jobs because of what they could not do. How does a hostage persuade his kidnapper not to kill him to prevent him from identifying the kidnapper in court? One option is to deliberately blind himself. A better one is to confess to a shameful secret that the kidnapper can use as blackmail. If he has no shameful secret, he can create one by having the kidnapper photograph him in some unspeakably degrading act. Threats and defenses against threats are the arena in which Dr. Strangelove really comes into his own. Threatener has an interest in carrying out the threat. For example, the threat is costly to the threatener, so its value is only as a deterrent. Again, freedom is costly. The threat is credible only when the threatener has no choice but to carry it out and the target knows it. Otherwise, the target can threaten the threatener right back by refusing to comply. The doomsday machine is an obvious example, though the secrecy defeated its purpose. Anyone tries to disarm him will have a better chance of seeing Cuba if he wears explosives that go off with if he wears jostling. A good way to win the teenager's game of chicken, in which two cars approach each other at high speed and the first driver to swerve loses speed, is to conspicuously remove your own steering wheel and throw it away. Remains incommunicado after making the ransom demand, so he cannot be persuaded to give up the hostage for a smaller ransom or a safe escape. Rationality is also a liability. Schelling points out that he will stab himself unless you give him $10, he is more likely to get the $10 if his eyes are bloodshot. Terrorists, kidnappers, hijackers, and dictators of small countries have an interest in appearing mentally unbalanced. An absence of self-interest is also an advantage. Suicide bombers are almost impossible to stop. To defend yourself against threats, make it impossible for the threatener to make you an offer you can't refuse. Again, freedom, information, and rationality are handicaps. To make you an offer you can't, says the sticker on the delivery truck. A man who is worried that his daughter may be kidnapped would remain incommunicado, lobby for a law that makes it a crime to pay ransom, Invading army may burn bridges behind it to make retreat impossible. An invading army has no influence. A racketeer cannot sell protection if the customer makes sure he is not at home, if the racketeer comes around. Because an expensive threat works both ways, it can lead to a cycle of self-incapacitation. Protesters attempt to block the construction of a nuclear power plant by lying down on the railroad tracks leading to the site. The railroad company counters by telling the engineer to set the throttle so that the train moves very slowly and then to jump out of the train and walk beside it. The protesters must scramble. Next time, the protesters handcuff themselves to the tracks. The engineer does not dare leave the train. But the protesters must be certain the engineer sees them in enough time to stop. The engineer sees them in enough time to stop. The engineer does not dare leave to a nearsighted engineer. In these examples, many of them from Schelling, the paradoxical power comes from a physical constraint like handcuffs or an institutional constraint like the police. But strong passions can do the same thing. Say a bargainer publicly announces that he will not pay more than $16,000 for the car, and everyone knows he could not tolerate the shame of going back on his word. The unavoidable shame is as effective as the enforceable bet. The shame of going. Teresa offered to sell you her car, you would not insist on a guarantee because presumably she is you. The hothead who can figuratively explode at any moment enjoys the same tactical advantage as the you. In The Maltese Falcon, Sam Spade, Humphrey Bogart, dares the henchman of Casper Gutman, Sidney Greenstreet, to kill him, knowing that they need him to retrieve the Falcon. Gutman replies, delicate judgment on both sides, because as you know, sir, in the heat of action, men are likely to forget where their best interests lie, judgment on both sides. In The Godfather, Vito Corleone tells the head of the other crime families, he tells a superstitious man, and if some unlucky accident should befall my son, if my son is struck by a bolt of lightning, I will blame some of the people here. Dr. Strangelove meets the Godfather. Is passion a doomsday machine? Lost control. They may be irrational. They may act against their interests. The man running amok calls to mind a doomsday machine that has been set off. But though this be madness, yet... Precisely these sacrifices of will and reason are effective tactics in the countless bargains, promises, and threats that make up our social relations. The theory stands the romantic model on its head. The passions are no vestige of an animal past, no wellspring of creativity, no enemy of the intellect. The intellect is designed to relinquish control to the passions so that they may serve as guarantors of its offers, promises, and threats against suspicions that they are lowballs, double crosses, and bluffs. Offers, promises, and ineluctable part of the architecture of the brain. It has been programmed in deliberately because programmed in deliberate in control can they be credible guarantors. The doomsday machine theory has been proposed independently by Schelling, Trivers, Daly, and Wilson, the economist Jack Hirschleifer, and the economist Robert Frank. Righteous Daly and Wilson is a credible deterrent if it is uncontrollable and unresponsive to the deterrer's cost. Such compulsions, though useful in the long run, can drive people to fight far out of proportion to the stakes. In 1982, Argentina annexed the British colony of the Falklands, desolate islands with virtually no economic or strategic importance. British colony of the Falklands them as an immediate deterrent to anyone with designs on the rest of its empire, but at that point there was no empire. Frank points out that for what they spent to reclaim the islands, Britain could have given each Falklander a Scottish castle and a lifetime pension. But most Britons were proud that they stood up to the Argentinians. The same sense of fairness makes us sue expensively for Britons were proud despite red tape that costs us more in lost wages than the product was worth. The lust for revenge is a particularly terrifying emotion. All over the world, relatives of the slain fantasize day and night about the bittersweet moment when they might avenge a life with a life and find peace at last. The emotion strikes us as primitive and dreadful because we have contracted the government to settle our scores for us. But in many societies, an irresistible thirst for vengeance is one's only settle our scores for differ in the resolve with which they will suffer costs to carry out vengeance. Since that result vengeance to deterrent only if it is advertised, it is accompanied by the emotion traditionally referred to as honor, the desire to public honor, the desire to public advertised. The hair trigger of honor and revenge can be tuned to the degree of threat in the environment. of threat to vengeance are raised to godly virtues in societies that lie beyond the reach of law enforcement, such as remote horticulturalists and herders, as remote horticulturalists, Wild West, street gangs, organized crime families, and entire nation states when dealing with one another. But even within a modern state society, where it serves no purpose, the emotion of vengeance no purpose be turned off. Most legal theories, even from the highest-minded philosophers, acknowledge that retribution is one of the legitimate goals. Over and above the goals of deterring potential criminals and incapacitating, deterring, and rehabilitating the offender. The goals of deterrence from the American legal system have recently pressed for a say in plea bargaining and sentencing decision. No one can examine the emotions without seeing in them the source of much human tragedy. I don't think we should tragic animals. It's clear enough how natural selection engineered our instincts to suit our needs. We shouldn't blame selfish genes, either. They endow us with selfish motives, but they just as surely endow us with the capacity for love and a sense of justice. What we should appreciate and fear is the cunning designs of the emotions themselves. Many of their specs are not for gladness and understanding. Think of the happiness treadmill, the siren song, the sham emotions, the doomsday machines, the caprice of romance, the pointless punishment of grief and song, the sham emotions, when we are wrong and emboldens us to fight when we ought to surrender. Drivers writes, consider an argument between two closely bound people, say husband and wife. Both parties believe that one is an altruist, believe that one is relatively pure in motive and much abused, while the other is characterized by a pattern of selfishness spread over hundreds of incidents. It is noteworthy that the argument may appear to burst forth spontaneously, yet as it rolls along, two whole landscapes of information processing appear to lie already organized, waiting only for the light organizer to show themselves. In cartoons and movies, the villains are mustache-twirling degenerates, convinced of their rectitude. Many biographers of evil men start out assuming that their subjects are cartoonists, and reluctantly discover that they are ideologues and moralists. If Hitler was an actor, concluded one, he was an actor who believed in the part. Still, thanks to the complexity of our minds, we need not be perpetual do our minds, we need not be perpetual do the part. Some designed for virtue, some designed for reason, some clever enough to outwit the parts that are neither. One self may deceive another, but every now and then, a third self sees the truth. Family values. Come on, people now, smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another right now. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. Harmony and understanding, sympathy and trustable. Living dreams of visions, mystic crystal revelation, and the mind's true liberation. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. I say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be one. Incredible as it may seem, many of us used to believe this treacle. 1960s and 70s was that mistrust, jealousy, competitiveness, greed, and manipulation were social institutions. 70s was that mistrust, unnecessary evils like slavery or the denial of the vote to women. Others thought they were hidebound traditions whose inefficiency had gone unnoticed, as with the genius who figured out that toll bridges could charge a dollar to the traffic going one way instead of 50 cents to the traffic going both ways. These sentiments came not just from rock musicians, but from America's distinguished book, The Greening of America. The Yale Law professor Charles Reich heralded a nonviolent revolution being led by the college-age generation. The youth of America had evolved a new consciousness, he said. It was less guiltless, he said, non-judgmental, non-competitive, non-materialistic, affectionate, honest, unmanipulative, unaggressive, communal, and unconcerned with status and careers. The new consciousness, emerging like flowers through the pavement, was expressed in their music, communes, hitchhiking, drugs, moon-gazing, peace salute, and even their clothing. Bell-bottoms, he said, give the ankles a special freedom as if to invite dancing right on the street. Bell-bottoms, he said, give the ankles... Bell-bottoms, he said, give the ankles a special freedom, liberated individual. Its ultimate creation will be a new and enduring wholeness and will be a renewed relationship of man to himself, to other men, to society, to nature, and to the land. Greening sold a million copies in a few months. It was serialized in the New Yorker and discussed in a dozen articles in the New York Times, and copies in a few months. John Kenneth Galbraith gave it a positive review, though with a caveat positive in his title, Who's Minding the Store? The book recently came out in a 25th anniversary edition. Reich wrote his book in the Yale dining halls and based it on his conversations with the students there. With Mom and Dad paying the bills, everyone around them coming from the upper classes, and upcoming credentials about to launch them into the expanding economy of the 1960s, it was easy to believe that all you need is love. Today, Reich's generation became the Gucci-wearing, Beamer-driving, condo-owning, gourmet baby-breeding urban professionals of the 19 was a style as ephemeral as the bell-bottoms, a status symbol that distanced them from rednecks, jocks, and the less hip preppies. As the post-60s rock musician Elvis Costello asked, was it a millionaire who said, imagine no possessions? The Woodstock Nation was not the first utopian dream to be shattered. The free love communes of 19th-century America collapsed from sexual jealousy and the resentment of both sexes over the leader's habit of accumulatory America. Utopias of the 20th century became repressive empires led by men who collected Cadillacs, In anthropology, one South Sea Island paradise after another has turned out to be nasty and brutish. Migratology, once fied and free of crime. It turned out that the boys tutored one another in rape techniques. She called the Arapesh gentle. They were headhunters. She said that the Chambuli reversed our sex roles, the men wearing curls and makeup. In fact, the men beat their wives, exterminated neighboring tribes, and treated homicide as a milestone in a young man's life. In Human Universals, the anthropologist Donald universals the traits that, as far as we know, are found in all human cultures. They include prestige and status, inequality of power and wealth, inheritance, reciprocity, punishment, sexual modesty, sexual regulations, sexual jealousy, reciprocity, punishment, a division of labor by sex, including more child care by women and greater public child dominance by men, hostility to other groups, and conflict within the group, including violence, rape, and murder. The list should come as no surprise to anyone familiar with history, current events, or literature. There are a small number of plots in the world's fiction and drama, and the scholar Georges Bolti claims to have listed them all. More than 80% are defined by adversaries, often murderous, by tragedies of kinship or love, or both. In the real world, our life stories are largely stories of conflict. The hurts, guilt, and rivalries inflicted by parents, siblings, children, spouses, lovers, friends, and competitors. Notwithstanding, that means it is largely about inborn motives that put us into conflict with one another. Given that our brains were shaped by natural selection, it could hardly be otherwise. Natural selection is driven by the competition among genes to be represented in the next generation. Reproduction leads to a geometric increase in descendants, and on a finite planet, several generations hence. Therefore, organisms reproduce to some extent at organisms' expense. If one organism eats a fish, that fish is no longer available to be eaten by another organism. If one organism mates with one, it denies an opportunity at parenthood to a third. Everyone alive today is a descendant of millions of generations of ancestors. Opportunity at parenthood. That means that all people today owe their existence to having winners as ancestors, and everyone today is designed, at least in some circumstances, to compete. That does not mean that people, or any other animals, house an aggressive urge that must be discharged, an unconscious death wish, a rapacious sex drive, a territorial imperative, a thirst for territorial imperative, a thirst for, and unconquated with Darwinism. In The Godfather, Sollozzo says to Tom Hagen, "I don't like violence, Tom. I'm a businessman. Blood is a big expense." Even in the harshest competition, an intelligent organism must be a strategist, assessing whether its goals might best be served by retreat, conciliation, or living and letting live. As I explained, it is genes, not organisms, that must compete or die. Sometimes the gene's best strategy is to design organisms that cooperate, compete or die. Natural selection does not forbid cooperation and generosity. It just makes them difficult generosity problems like stereoscopic vision. The difficulty of building an organism to see in stereo has not prevented natural selection from endoscopic vision. Come to understand stereo if we thought it just came free with having two eyes and failed to look with having sophisticated neural programs that accomplish it. Similarly, the difficulty of building an organism to cooperate and be generous has not come to cooperation from installing cooperation and generosity in humans. But we will never understand these capacities if we think that cooperation. Onboard computers of social organisms, especially of humans, should run sophisticated programs that assess the opportunities and risks at hand and compete or cooperate accordingly. The conflict of interest among the members of a species also does not call for a conservative political agenda, as journalists and social scientists often fear. Violence would be morally correct. Since they are deplorable, conflict had better not be deplorable. The reasoning, of course, is fallacious. Nothing says that nature has to be nice, and what people want to do is not necessary and ought to do. Others worry that if conflicting motives are inevitable, it would be futile to try to reduce violence and exploitation. Our current social arrangements would be the best one can hope for. But that does not follow either. Among modern Western societies, homicide rates vary from 0.5 per million persons per year in Iceland in the first half of the 20th century to 10 in most European countries at present, to 25 in Canada, to 100 in the United States and Brazil. Academic question of whether it can ever be reduced to zero. Moreover, there are ways to reduce conflict other than to dream of a golden future of indiscriminate love. People in all societies not only perpetrate violence but deplore it. Steps to reduce violent conflict, such as sanctions, redress, censure, mediation, ostracism and law. Conflict, such as so that I can get on with the content of the chapter. My goal is not to convince you that people don't always want the best for one another, but to try to explain when and why that should be true. But sometimes the trite has to be stated. The observation that created condition, banal though it is, contradicts fashionable beliefs. Another is the assumption that we unthinkingly play out the roles society assigns to us, and that social reform is a matter of rewriting the roles. I suspect that if you pressed many academics and social critics, you would find views no less utopian than those of Charles Reich. If the mind is an organ of computation engineered by natural selection, our social motives should be strategy. If the mind, people should have distinct kinds of thoughts and feelings about kin and non-kin, and about parents, children, siblings, dates, spouses, acquaintances, friends, rivals, allies, and enemies. A man and a woman can fall in love, and the key ingredient is an expression of commitment. A man and a woman need each other's DNA and hence can enjoy sex. A man and a woman have a common interest in their children, and their enduring love has evolved to protect that interest. The lifelong dependability and trust that underlies the logic of friendship. More on this later. These emotions are rooted in the fact that if a man and woman are monogamous, together for life, and not nepotistic toward their own families, unfortunately, that is a big if. Even the happiest couples can fight like cats and dogs. Today, 50% of marriages in the United States end in divorce. George Bernard Shaw wrote, "When we want to read of the deeds that are done for love, whither do we turn? To the murder column." Conflict between men and women, sometimes deadly, is universal, and it suggests column. 1. Once again, that banality must be stated because the conventional wisdom denies stated because one of the utopian ideals of the 1960s, reiterated ever since by sex gurus like Dr. Ruth, is the intensely erotic, mutually enjoyable, guilt-free, emotionally open, lifelong monogamous pair bond. The alternative from the counterculture was the alternative from the counterculture was the emotionally open round-robin orgy. Both were attributed to our hominid ancestors, to earlier stages of civilization, or to primitive tribes still out there somewhere. Both are as mythical as the Garden of Eden. The battle between the sexes is not just a skirmish in the war between unrelated individuals, but is fought in a different theater, for reasons first explained by Donald Simons. With respect to human sexuality, he wrote, there is a female human nature and a male human nature, and these natures are extraordinarily different. Men and women differ in their sexual natures because throughout the immensely long hunting and gathering phase of human evolutionary history, the sexual desires and dispositions that were adaptive for either sex were for the other evolutionary history. The sexual desires and dispositions that there are any interesting differences between the sexes. At my own institution, students at my own gender used to be taught that the only well-established difference between men and women is that men like women and women like men. Science's two human natures are dismissed as gender stereotypes, as if that were proof that they are false. The belief that spiders spin webs and pigs don't, gender stereotype. As we shall see, some stereotypes about sexual feelings have been verified beyond a reasonable In fact, researchers in sex difference have found that many gender stereotypes underestimate the documented differences between the sexes. The first question of strategy is how many partners to want. A male can have more offspring if he mates with many females, but a female does not have she mates with many males. One per conception is enough. Suppose a foraging man with one wife can expect 2 to 5 children with her. A premarital or extramarital liaison that conceives a child would increase his reproductive output by 20 to 50%. Father isn't around, the father is genetically no better off. The optimal liaison, then, is with a married woman whose husband would bring up the child. In foraging societies, fertile women are almost always married, so sex with a woman is usually sex with a married woman. Even if she is not, more fatherless children live than die, so a liaison with an unmarried partner can increase reproduction, too. None of this math applies to women. A part of the male mind, then, should want a variety of sexual partners for the sheer sake of having a variety of partners for the sheer sake of having a variety of women. But the only difference between men and women is that men like women and women like men? Any bartender or grandmother, you ask, would say that men are more likely to have a wandering eye, but perhaps that is just an old-fashioned stereotype. Likely to refute it. Men and women in elite liberal American universities a generation after the revolution, in the heyday of politically correct sensibilities. The methods are refreshingly direct. Confidential questionnaires asked a series of questions. How strongly are you seeking a spouse? The answers were on average identical for men and women. How strong said not very strongly. The men said pretty strongly. How many sexual partners would you like to have in the next month, in the next 2 years, in your lifetime? Women said that in the next month, 8/10 of a sexual partner would be just about right. They wanted one in the next 2 years and 4 or 5 over their lifetimes. They wanted one in 18 over their lifetimes. Would you consider having sex with a desirable partner that you had known for 5 years, for 2 years, for a month, for a week? Women said probably yes for a man they had known for a year, probably yes for one they had known for 6 months, and definitely not for someone they had known a week or less. Men said probably yes, as long as they had known the woman for a week. How short a time would a man have to know a woman before he would definitely not have sex with her? Buss never found out. His scale did not go down past 1 hour. When Buss presented these findings at a university and explained them in terms of parental investment and sexual selection, a young woman raised her hand and said, Professor Buss, I have a simpler explanation of parental investment and sexual selection. Are men really slime, or are they just trying to look like slime? Or Are they just trying? Questionnaires, men try to exaggerate their studliness, but women want to avoid looking easy. The psychologists R. Clark and Elaine Hatfield hired attractive men and women to approach strangers of the opposite sex on a college campus and say to them, I've been noticing you're attractive men and women, ask one of three questions. A. Would you go out with me tonight? B. Would you come over to an apartment tonight? C. Would you go to bed with me tonight? Half the women consented to a date. Half the men consented to a date. 6% of the women consented to go to the Stooges' apartment. 69% of the men consented to go to the Stooges' apartment. Percent of the men consented to sex. Of the remaining 25%, many were apologetic, asking for a rain check or explaining that they couldn't because their fiancé was in town. The results have been replicated in several states. When the studies were conducted, contraception was widely available, and safe sex practices were heavily publicized, contraception was widely sexually transmitted diseases. End of side 7. Please turn to side 8.